Dear Clint Barton, circa age 7, by Polly Repeat, read by Rose. He doesn't remember any of it, but he can't go anywhere in the Avengers Tower without being confronted by evidence that, yes, Clint Barton, this is actually your life. There are 3 nightlights in his room, all shaped like dinosaurs. They are a new addition he doesn't remember asking for, and they turn on automatically at 8 o'clock every night, without fail. There's a big print book of animal adventure stories gathering dust under his bed. He'd knocked it from its place of apparent pride under his pillow in his initial panic upon waking up in his pajamas, about 1,000,000 sizes too small. He can't quite bring himself to retrieve it, or touch it. There's sugary cereal in every kitchen cupboard on every floor, and normally this could be explained away as belonging to Thor or Tony, but it's all been carefully, deliberately placed on bottom shelves within easy reach of, say, a small child. There's a toy chest in Tony's workshop that isn't just full of robot parts. The DVR is full of children's shows, and there are childproof locks on the cabinets and covers on all of the outlets, and tiny plastic benches and bathrooms and booster seats in the dining rooms. There are bath toys in his bathtub. Dear past Clint, Clint mutters to himself, and then winces, because awkward, and also way more literal than the haranguing internal monologues he usually directs at his past self. Dear past Clint, he tries again, and this time he directs it at the bright purple rubber duck, sitting nonchalantly beside the bathroom sink. You fucking suck. Clint doesn't remember being terribly given to spilling his guts as a child. The first time around, at least, since apparently there's been a second time. He was a quiet kid, and a quiet teenager, and he's a quiet adult unless someone has him particularly riled up. Point is, he thinks, it's fucking suspicious that a whole handful of people that he's fine beating up aliens with and or indulging in victory shawarma with, but really not okay with sharing intimate personal details with, suddenly know, well, terrifyingly intimate personal details about him. It's not the toys or the childproofing that's freaking him out exactly. Although, spotting a stack of Bernstein Bears books or a tiny plastic bow when he's not expecting it continues to make him feel like someone's sitting on his chest, compressing his lungs and making it hard to breathe. No, it's everything else. Or rather, everyone else. Clint's used to being kind of invisible, and that's the way he likes it. Enter a room, half the people glance up. One or two say hello, and everyone goes back to what they were doing, and nobody asks questions. That was life in the Avengers Tower. Past tense. Now, Clint enters a room, and he's immediately the center of attention. 1,000-yard stares all around, and that's supposed to be his job. Thor and Tony both got very touchy while Clint was away. Hand on his arm here, arm around his shoulder there, touch, 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 and Clint knows when he was a kid he would have liked this, would have been quietly thrilled at any sort of affection, but the boat has sailed on that one, okay? Maybe if he'd grown up different, he'd be into regular invasions of his personal space, but Clint did just fine with what he had, and Tony and Thor can back the fuck off. It's too late to change anything, but nobody seems to get that but him.
Agent Barton?
Jarvis says, and Clint realizes abruptly that he's been staring at a rubber duck and muttering to himself for several long minutes already.
Miss Potts would like me to indicate to you that dinner will be served in 10 minutes.
Thanks, Clint says. He closes the shower curtain so he can't see the blue plastic tugboat or the bottle of bubble bath. I'm not hungry, but thanks. There's a pause while Jarvis presumably passes that message on to Pepper and whoever else is sitting around waiting for him to show up. Based on experiences from the last 2 days, the entire fucking team.
It's spaghetti and meatballs,
Jarvis said, like this is supposed to entice him. Clint picks up the rubber duck between his thumb and forefinger and tosses it behind the shower curtain to bounce against the side of the tub, unseen. I'm still not hungry, he says. Another pause.
Captain Rogers has decided this is to be a working supper, Jarvis says. Team attendance is mandatory. He intends to cover the preliminary briefing for tomorrow's meeting with S.H.I.E.L.D.
Steve. Steve got quiet and watchful in Clint's absence, and he looks at Clint like he's seeing someone that he needs to protect. Steve looks like that about pretty much the entire world, but the intensity's been dialed up to 11. Fucking fine, Clint sighs, and makes his way to the elevator. He accidentally crushes a plastic cowboy under his boots on the way out the door. No regrets. Clint arrives at dinner to find Steve and Tony having a furious argument that seems to be centered around Tony being manipulative and having Jarvis pretend that he's Steve. Pepper has her nose buried in a Stark tablet, occasionally reaching out with one bare foot to poke Tony in the thigh when he makes a particularly egregious point.
"Spaghetti isn't mandatory,"
Steve says when he catches sight of Clint. Everyone else looks up abruptly.
"This isn't a team meeting."
"But since you're already here, you might as well eat," Tony says, jovial and expansive. He nudges a chair out with his foot. Someone's already dished out a plate full of spaghetti for him. Two of the meatballs have been neatly cut in half, like someone started to do the job by habit, and then remembered that Clint is not a 7-year-old, and stopped. Bruce follows Clint's gaze to the pre-sliced meatballs, then has some sort of conversation with Tony using only their eyes. And when Tony nods in something like victory, Bruce reaches out and pulls the plate over to himself.
"Oh no," he says unconvincingly. "How did my plate get over there?"
Clint sighs and sits. Underneath the table, Natasha sets her foot gently on top of Clint's boot and leaves it there. Clint is okay with this. He's not going to add it to the large and growing list of disquieting new quirks acquired by teammates in my absence. It probably helps that Tasha is one of the few people he doesn't mind letting into his personal space. From almost the beginning, she's always been free to lean up against his side or prop her feet up in his lap, or vice versa. In the early days, Coulson pointed out that arbitrarily deciding a super assassin was safe to have draped over your back was an exercise in sure snap my neck. I wasn't using that anyway. But Coulson once fell asleep after a ruthlessly difficult mission and listed over into Natasha's lap for an entire 5-hour flight, so he has no room to talk. Conversation over dinner is surprisingly unstilted. The last time Clint attended team dinners, that he can remember, ugh. They were all still inching their way out of the getting-to-know-you stage of new partnerships. It's clear that they've all moved beyond that now, except him. Clint missed the whole first part of getting the Avengers together on account of being brainwashed, and now he has apparently missed the whole part in which everyone bonded and, okay, so he eats spaghetti a little despondently. Even though no one tries to pour his juice for him, which is an improvement on breakfast. "You didn't like shouting," Natasha tells him later. Because Natasha knows him best, and sees all and understands way more than Clint would like sometimes. So we tried talking instead. That makes something turn in his stomach.
"Yay," he says,
and Natasha punches him in the arm. She doesn't pull it, although she does pick him back off the floor from where he's fallen over. And she helps him gather up some of the scattered plastic animals and dispose of the bath toys. Clint spends the night in an empty barracks room on the helicarrier. He endured a whole day of being poked and prodded by medical when he first changed back. And usually, Clint would be wary of putting himself back in their white-coated, large-needled reach, but the dinosaur nightlights turned themselves on at 8 and refused to be pried out of the sockets, with any amount of force.
"They are child-proof, sir," Jarvis said apologetically,
but then couldn't explain the trick to get them out. And Clint just couldn't take it anymore. He fled. He's not too proud to admit it. The helicarrier cots are hard and unpleasant, and so he rises early with the intention of getting a workout in before sucking it up and heading back to the tower, where he didn't leave any sort of note before stealing the jet, unless a resounding "fuck you, nightlights" at Jarvis counts. He jogs through the corridors aimlessly, letting his feet pick which twists and turns to take, a decision-making process that works well right up until he turns a corner and almost runs full tilt into Director Fury, coming from the other direction.
Says Clint. "Sorry, sir."
Fury regards him for a moment, expressionless. As far as Clint knows, Fury isn't one of the gawkers who came by to see him all grown up again. Although Fury is sneakier than most of the agents he employs and had, you know, an actual legitimate reason to be there.
"With me, Barton," Fury says finally. "I have a couple of your things."
Clint has a really bad feeling about this. But there's no other option but to follow Fury down another couple of corridors, through an office where a woman that Clint recognizes as Fury's terrifyingly efficient administrative assistant, Gloria, is sitting at a desk. Then through a door and into a second office. Clint abruptly knows exactly where he is. This is Fury's private sanctum, deep in the bowels of the helicarrier. Clint's never been here before, but it's starting to look like Mini-Me had an all-access pass to the entire world. Fury's got picture frames on his desk and on the walls that look like regular print ones until you get a little closer and realize by the faint glow that they're all digital. A lot of the senior agents have something similar in their offices. Easy to switch over to a nondescript landscape if someone comes by, and you don't want them to know that you have an emotional connection to anything at all. Right underneath a photo of Coulson's face, covered in mud and leaves, and squinting suspiciously at the camera, there's a shot of Fury himself. He's giving a floppy-haired, moon-faced little kid a piggyback ride. The kid's mouth is open wide, like one of the emoticon smiley faces Thor likes to use in his text messages and emails. Grin face. No, Clint says.
Yep, Fury says. More than once.
With a normal person, this might count as blackmail material. But A, this is a case of mutually assured destruction, if ever there was one, and B, Fury is immune to embarrassment. Not just in the regular Tony Stark way, either. Oh, no. Things that could possibly end up being embarrassing to Fury get somehow warped and changed until they go from mortifying all the way over into useful and or good for his image. It's like a superpower. Carrying Clint's small child self around on his shoulder more than once has probably already hit the intricacy rumor mill as an example of Fury's innate awesomeness. Good with rocket launchers and small children.
Thanks? Clint says, uncertain.
Fury retrieves an orange sippy cup from one of the bookshelves and hands it over.
You're welcome, Fury says. Stop by Gloria's desk on your way out. She's been storing your favorite blanket. You left it on my couch last week.
Clint thinks it's probably completely normal that he kind of just wants to fall over and die, or slip into a coma or something, just to keep from having to deal with any of this anymore. He retrieves the blanket on his way out. He doesn't particularly want to carry a soft blue baby blanket through the halls of his workplace. And after a moment of impassive-faced staring, Gloria takes pity on him and fishes a plastic grocery bag out from the depths of her desk. No problem, hun, she says in response to his muttered,
thanks.
And then she makes a face, like that wasn't at all what she intended to say. The biggest issue, Clint thinks, is that he was 7 again for nearly 6 whole months. That's more than enough time for people to form habits and get into routines. 6 months is just barely less time than he's known half the team as an adult, for God's sakes. I can't even blame people for being weird, he tells Coulson Ceiling. I would probably be weird.
Coulson says. Gee, thanks,
Clint says, because he knows that particular noise means you aren't weird already. If Coulson also played host to Mini-Clint, he's done a better job of tidying up the evidence than most. No toys or books or blankets in sight. Aside from the one Clint shoved beside the bookcase, still in its plastic bag. No mortifying photos. Coulson's office is much safer than nearly any other place Clint frequents. Maybe he'll spend more of his time not hiding on Coulson's couch.
I don't have to like it, though, Clint says, continuing his earlier thought.
Coulson's a sport because he doesn't tell Clint to get off his couch and go see the actual mental health professionals in their offices in medical. Just says,
if you want to stay, you have to do half this paperwork.
Coulson hates paperwork. It's his arch nemesis. Fine, Clint says, forgetting that the combination of comfy office couch, horrifically boring requisition paperwork, and poor night's sleep tend to be a reliably potent knockout for him. He blinks open his eyes some unknown time later, papers crumpled under his cheek, uncertain for a moment what actually woke him. Coulson, holding the blanket from Fury's office in his hands, freezes in the act of spreading it out to put over Clint.
God damn it, Clint says with feeling.
Clint flees Phil's office without looking back, leaving the fuzzy blanket, sippy cup, and crushing sense of doom behind him, at least for now. Phil lets him go without comment, although he does have the decency to show Clint his slightly sheepish face as Clint speedwalks out the door. What Clint wants more than anything else right now is a small, dark, quiet space full of things for grown-ups like weaponry and dirty magazines, and cups that don't have lids, and pants without built-in slippers. A closet might work, or any one of the tiny bunks scattered throughout the helicarrier. But he's starting to regard S.H.I.E.L.D. as enemy territory, and if Fury's office isn't safe, then nothing here is safe. He should have known that before he ever went to see Phil. Somewhere else, then, he thinks. He's trying to remember if any of his known safe houses in the area are still operational after the 6-month gap in his memory when there's a shout from down the hall. Barton, Deputy Director Hill, with Agent Sitwell right on her heels. Sitwell did come to gawk in medical, although he also flashed a friendly thumbs up and smuggled in a hamburger while Clint was waiting for the doctors to cut him loose, so Clint figures he can cut him some slack for that.
Please, Clint says, as they catch up to him, please tell me that you don't have any of my
of that kid's belongings.
No, Hill says, sharp. But that's nothing new. Hill is always sharp. Spending any time with her usually results in fervent thanks that she's on S.H.I.E.L.D.'s team. That's pretty much the general consensus regarding any of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s specialists or long-term agents, so she fits right in. Although, a pause. Clint didn't think his stomach could sink any lower than its new permanent position, post-dechilding. But apparently it can.
Although, you left a cache,
Sitwell says.
In the storage space by my office. You asked...
You asked me, says Hill, to make sure nobody stole it from you. I've been keeping an eye on it.
I asked you to.
I helped you pick the space, Hill says. Pick up your stuff, Barton. I'm sick of looking at it.
She kicked me in the head, offers Sitwell.
You didn't have clearance to be in there, Hill says.
I was boxing it up to bring it over to him.
Insufficient clearance.
Look, says Clint. I don't actually need any of that. Kid Clint had a lot of stuff, okay? Like, a lot of stuff. I've been tripping over it or falling into it since I've gotten back, and I'm sick of it. Deputy Director Hill, respectfully, you don't need to look after it. I don't want it.
Sitwell and Hill both let their faces wipe to pleasant stillness, which is a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent party trick that occasionally makes for frustrating interpersonal relationships. We don't actually have a lot of use for Nerf guns or Legos in the helicarrier, Barton. I don't care what you do with it, but deal with it. She turns on her heel and walks away, and Sitwell casts Clint a sympathetic look.
Where did everything come from? Clint says. I wasn't kidding. I feel like all I've done for days is clean up embarrassing toys. You had a birthday when you were a kid. Did you know that? 2 months in.
Oh, God, says Clint. Sitwell pushes his glasses up his nose.
You were really stunned when Stark started planning your party, he says. We all figured you never really got a chance to celebrate it. I guess everyone went overboard.
Everyone?
Tony Stark planned your birthday party, says Coulson, appearing from around the corner. It may have been the largest gathering of covert agency employees and superheroes in history.
Oh, says Clint.
All attendance was voluntary, Coulson says, and my apologies about earlier.
It's fine, says Clint, ignoring Sitwell's curious eyebrow raise. Like I said,
weirdness free pass.
Coulson smiles a tiny smile, and just like that, they're okay again.
I ran into Hill a couple minutes ago. She wanted me to remind you.
I know, said Clint.
All my stuff.
She was very diligent, Coulson says. Sitwell nodding in fervent counterpoint.
Not everyone takes a promise to a 7-year-old that seriously.
Ah, I'm...
Right, he says. All right. Come on, Sitwell says. I know the way.
Late one night, bathed in the soft blue glow of the nightlights, Clint makes a rule. For every hour he spends avoiding everyone, he has to spend a minimum of 2 hours sucking it up and hanging out with people, even if they hand him sippy cups and sling 2 familiar arms around his shoulder. It's like ripping off a band-aid, or yanking a knife out of your leg once you're sure it hasn't hit anything vital. Get it over with, fast, and keep going. It probably won't kill you. Bruce is the one who helps him pry the nightlights out, shows him the little button hidden on the bottom of a dinosaur foot that helps him unstick it from the wall socket.
It's uncomfortable, Bruce says, head down and concentrate on dinosaur number 2. To let it all hang out for everyone to see.
Clint's pretty sure he's not talking about being naked, unless it's the emotional kind. He also supposes that Bruce knows what he's talking about.
Huh,
he says, and yanks. Dinosaur number 3 comes out with a pop and flies across the room. Bruce sticks it in the pile with the other 2.
Thanks, Clint says. Right, Bruce says. What else needs to go? And if you still have any of the plastic farm animals left, I vote for leaving them in Tony's bed.
It isn't until later he remembers the Book of Animal Adventures. It's dusty when he rescues it from under the bed. When he flips it open, idly, pages of loose paper flutter out, covered in Steve's sketches. There's the kid who rode piggyback displayed up on Fury's wall, and one he's dressed up in Clint's gear, artistic license probably, and labeled the superhero Hawkeye. And another where he's wearing Thor's cape and shooting a Nerf gun at Tony and Pepper and Natasha in blatant disregard for his personal safety.
Yes, Clint Barton, this is your actual life, he thinks to himself.
The rest are all pictures of the team, Bruce drinking coffee and wearing Tony draped all over his back, reading the paper over his shoulder, Thor flat on the floor with Jane Foster sitting cross-legged on his chest, a self-portrait of Steve from the back, shoulders hunched in like he's laughing to himself, everyone else arrayed in front of him in various stages of argument. When the call to assemble comes, Clint's feeling settled in his own skin for the first time in weeks. Sure, he found one of the plastic cows inside his quiver, but the roof has a nice vantage point. The explosions are practically the sound of home, and everyone is so busy doing their jobs and rescuing civilians that there's no time to pester Clint or make embarrassing insinuations about his ability to handle himself. Those have mostly dropped off anyway. Or at least, they're back at levels no different than what everyone else on the team suffers. Iron Man, you're 3 o'clock, Clint says, arrow knocked and tracking the flying squid thing that's currently flailing in Stark's direction. The sky is full of them. 3 feet long, from tentacle tip to head. They're like the weirdest, most ungainly birds that New York has ever seen. They keep running into skyscraper windows and trying to eat people. Yeah, I see it, Stark says, sounding annoyed. He's in the middle of flipping around when a second squid drops like a stone from above and wraps itself tight around the Iron Man helmet.
Oh, says Stark. Heads up, Iron Man may be out of commission, Clint says.
Am not, says Stark, but his mid-air dance to free himself is becoming increasingly agitated.
I will join you, Thor promises over the comm.
So hey, Stark says, still clawing at his head. He sounds a little breathless. The squid refuses to be dislodged. Birthday parties. Steve's up next, right? Clint just barely stops himself from cringing.
Is he? Listen, short stuff, I'm sorry you didn't get to remember yours, but Pepper has a rule. Just because you don't remember the party doesn't mean you get an immediate do-over. You gotta wait your turn again, just like the rest of us.
Aha! Clint lets short stuff go as a lost cause. Tony called him that long before inconvenient de-aging, despite the obvious hypocrisy. Thor zooms by and smashes into Stark with obvious pleasure, ignoring the shout of, I almost had it, as he rips the squid off and flings it into the air. Clint skewers it at the apex of its ascent, and lets himself smile a little.
I think you should ask Coulson for help when you plan Cap's party, he says,
and grins outright at the reaction that gets over the comm line. Steve's official party, because there are two, including the super-secret private party that is so weirdly low-key for a Stark event that Pepper obviously looked after the whole thing. It's probably the party of the year. Tony says it's tied with the party that Clint doesn't remember. Clint is obviously unable to be the judge of that. He washes up in a corner with Steve near the end of the night. Steve did the circulating and glad-handing things, like the pro he is, but he definitely seems relieved to have found a quiet corner and a nice drink. Clint bumps glasses with him.
How are you doing? Steve says.
That's what I was going to ask you, Clint says.
Steve tips his glass at him. The protective intensity dial is back down to a 9 or so, but over the course of the last few adventures with aliens and supervillains, Clint's figured out that actually the entire team is sitting at a 9. He's okay with that.
Next up, Thor, says Steve.
They both glance over to where Thor is wrapping up verse 7 of the epic tale of the head-loving squid aliens. S.H.I.E.L.D. agents applaud enthusiastically. Someone, Tony, got Jarvis to start recording him when he does his epic storytelling thing. There are YouTube channels out there dedicated to auto-tuning the ones that make it past Pepper and setting them to music. It's very popular.
So that should be fun,
says Steve. Clint thinks about this.
Yeah, he decides, and is surprised to find he actually means it.
The end. Thanks for listening.